Meet Gail. Her thing is being a supermom. And supermom has a lot on her super-sized plate.
Ain't that the truth.
But at Walmart Pharmacy, supermom recently got her whole family updated on all their vaccines.
We knocked it out during a grocery run. No appointment.
That's next-level supermom. From pneumonia to shingles, HPV, and more, get no-cost vaccinations from an expert pharmacist where you already shop. Welcome to an easier pharmacy. Welcome to your Walmart. $0 copay with most insurances. State age and health restrictions may apply.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey, friends, and welcome to the Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey podcast. I'm your host, Jamie, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week on this show, I invite a friend to join me, and we chat about the big things in life, the little things in life, and everything in between.
I am clearly not Jamie Ivey. I'm Esau McCauley, the Associate Professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. And I'm filling in as a guest host on the Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey. And so forgive me for not being her. Forgive me for any inadequacies. Jamie's better at this than I am, but you're going to have to deal with us. So it's me today. I have a guest on the show, Jewel. He already messed it up. I told you he's going to mess up the name. Jamie wouldn't do that. Joe Mutamale, who is a PhD. You have your PhD in biblical theology. You are the theological director at Proverbs 31 Ministry. Is that the right title?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you also are on the preaching team at Transformation Church.
That's right.
As well. Is that accurate?
That's right. In South Carolina with our boys.
South Carolina.
There. Yeah. Derwin,
and I think Derwin's been on the podcast too. If he hasn't been on here, Derwin should be on here. And yeah. We're here to talk about your book, Humility, but about your book, Hidden Peace. We'll get to that for a second. But I have a real pressing question, because I was reading your book and you have a real interesting backstory.
Yeah.
You were born, I think, here in the States, right?
Yep. Yeah,
and
Chicago.
Then you went over to Japan you went over to India for a couple of years.
Yep.
And then you came back and you were raised in Chicago, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And in your book, you talk about Michael Jordan a lot.
Yes, I do. Yep.
Yes, you did. You did.
Yeah.
And I think you talked about him as being like the greatest basketball player of all time. So the question
GOAT.
I want to ask you for the people of Chicago, why do y'all hate LeBron? I'm not talking about like disagreement.
Oh, yeah.
I'm saying why can't LeBron be great? What's going on here? Can we settle this? We can get into humility.
We can settle this. This actually might be an exercise in humility right now, because the Lord's about to work in my heart. The one thing is, it's a misconception for the thought that just because I might say I'm for Michael Jordan as the greatest of all time, that equates to I hate LeBron James. So I think that's a misunderstanding. I don't hate LeBron James. In fact, Derwin and I have this conversation. The majority of our text messages are about this this fact. You know, I think LeBron is great.
So what does your pastor think? We'll get to the book. What does your pastor think?
You know, sanctification is an ongoing process.
I mean, you're going to answer the question, or you're going to?
So he's,
what does your pastor think?
He won't answer this question either. This is what he'll say.
Okay.
He'll say, "Why can't we just appreciate greatness on both sides?" That's his answer. Like a true peacemaker.
Like a good pastor.
Like a good pastor.
Why don't you submit to godly authority and like then adopt that position? Like, why are you being rebellious?
Yeah, because the Lord calls us to unity and diversity and not uniformity.
Unity and diversity.
So.
Okay, that's fair. So you wrote this book, and I want to make sure I get the title right. The Hidden Peace. Is that correct?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I know when you sat back and you thought about, you know, what can I do that's guaranteed to be a bestseller that everybody wants to read about, everybody wants to talk about, that the world is desperate to hear? It's a book on humility. So I want to know, the first question I want to know is that everybody who writes a book, begins with a personal passion. Something happens in them. God is doing something in their lives, or maybe they see something in the culture. What led you to write a book about humility?
Yeah, I think honestly, one of the things I think is important that I've experienced is this is a statement that I'll say at times, I wouldn't trust a theologian or a pastor or a scholar or a ministry leader that doesn't walk with a limp. And that comes from Genesis 32, the idea of Jacob, and he's got this limp after he wrestles with the Lord. And the big question Esau's like, why? Like, why, when Yahweh is walking away from him, why doesn't he just be like, hey, God, by the way, can you just touch the hip again? Put this bad boy back in place. You know what I'm saying?
Instead of,
and then the text is so explicit, and he limped away to Peniel. And it's like, in the ancient Near Eastern context, this is debilitating. He's going to walk everywhere, even just right, you know, like why? And I came to this conclusion, actually, that limp was not a sign or evidence of God's displeasure in his life. It was actually evidence of God's great grace in his life. It would be a marked and holy humility moment where he would remember his limitations, and the very place where his limitations are is the perfect place to experience the limitless nature of God. And so for me, I'm like, man, we're in a culture where fear is on the rise. Anxiety's on the rise. People are trying to gain more power, more strength, more control. I mean, right now while we're recording, there's a political cycle that's about to happen, and it's going to throw our world sideways. We've already seen this happen before, especially in the Christian world. And the question is it possible to experience true peace, like actual rest, not in the absence of all of this stuff, but actually in the midst of it? And kind of the biblical theological conclusion I came to is like there is, and yet it's going to require us to retrieve an ancient virtue that is easily rejected today, but is so vital for the Christian life, and that's humility.
So you began with a look at the culture and saw a lack of humility in the culture. Was there a particular moment or particular thing that you read or saw, or was there like a confirmation that, yes, this is the road that God has me on for this season of life?
Let me give you the intersections for me. One is, and you mentioned it early on, I'm Indian. My grandparents are missionaries in India. My parents are immigrants. You know, they're immigrants to this country. They worked really hard in order to provide a life for me and my younger brother and sister. And growing up as an Indian in the hood in Chicago, like we lived right outside the city. I would have gone to Proviso West, like if we stayed there, right? So we're in Bellwood, Maywood, Hillside, that area. It's difficult because people couldn't figure out, is Joel black or is he white or is he Latino?
Yeah.
So in the summertime, when my skin got real dark and I had a nice, real tight fade, all of my black friends were like, homie, come on, you're rolling with us. But in the wintertime, if I lost my tan and I let my hair grow out like how it is right now, all my Latino friends were like, all right, SA, you're rolling with us. And so here I am trying to figure out, like, where do I fit? Where do I belong?
Yeah.
And what that created in me, this is the personal part of it, is I felt like I had to be a chameleon to fit into all these different spaces. And that is actually an exercise of pride in a lot of ways, that I can, of my own ability, create that sense of belonging. And then the other thing that happened that I was watching out in the culture, so I'm a theological mutt all the way through. An undergraduate degree at a Pentecostal charismatic, like Assemblies of God, MDiv, seminary degree from a Presbyterian joint, did my PhD at a SBC Baptist spot. And at every spot that I was in, I would sit around these tables with brilliant scholars, brilliant theologians, fellow PhD students. And I was like, man, the thing that brings us together is humility, and the thing that creates deep senses of division within the church is pride. And it's a type of pride that's subversive. It's not like out in the open, but it's a type of pride that actually leverages the gospel and the scriptures as a weapon to win.
Man, you know? Listen, don't. I'm trying to stay out of trouble. I wanted to ask you, because you were talking about your degrees, and in the book you talked about, in a few places, how even the acquisition of degrees and getting letters behind your name and academic success is a potential source of pride, which is obviously the enemy of humility. Is it something that you talked about, leaders who walk with the limp? Is this kind of like, I need to write this book on on humility, because as someone who does theology and who's trained to debate and whose job it is to be an expert, is there a particular danger for leaders, Christian leaders, like as you mentioned here, to struggle with pride and humility?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a section in the book that where I talk about hidden pride, and literally, honestly, and it's hilarious. You saw how you started. Like, this isn't the book to like to become a New York Times bestselling author, right? Like of all the checklist things to do, literally, I preached a sermon actually on humility, and as I was kind of like processing through all this content, and I put it into this AI tool, the video clip, like, you know, from churches, actually Transformation Church, and I put it in, and the clip, what it does, it's kind of fascinating. It will break up the sermon into little like Instagram reels or YouTube shorts or whatever, into like 60, a minute and 30 seconds, but it's going to give it a viral score. So it's like, oh, this clip has 100% viral. This clip has like a zero, right? So the entire, you don't know, all seven clips, the viral score was like under 40%. And the number one line is nobody cares about humility. Like, humility is not a viral topic, right? Well, like all of that is happening.
I will tell you, people, I think that God has the books that people need, and books find their audience. I mean, when I wrote my book, Reading While Black, like, hermeneutics is not a like money making, like, no one says, you know what's selling like hotcakes these days? Hermeneutics. Right. And so the truth is, I think that as a writer, we are better off chasing that which God puts on our hearts and chasing reality, whatever you want to call it, viralness. Amen. And I think it's also important for, there's a way, I used to say this when I used to speak at churches. Maybe they stopped inviting me to, like, I still speak, but like, they stopped asking me to consult. That's it. Like, I am the worst church consultant in the world because I don't know what works. I I don't know what can help your church grow. If that's what you need, you should get somebody else. I can tell you what I think is true. It doesn't mean that like I'm the expert on truth. I'm saying, like, if you try to look at reality through the lens of what is going to be efficient and effective, that sometimes runs counter to the gospel. And what I think that is always a more faithful path is to do that which God puts on our hearts, and then leave the results to God. So you said, okay, I'm analyzing the culture, and what we need is to find this hidden peace. Why did you tie the language of peace to humility? How does humility lead to peace?
Yeah. So, you know, this is Matthew 11, 28 and 29. There's this incredible passage where Jesus is like, hey, let's do this exchange of yokes. You know, you've probably heard a thousand messages on the exchange of yokes. The thing that fascinated me, though, is it's this exchange of yokes. And he goes, it's an invitation. Come and take on my life. Come and follow me, because I am gentle and humble. And that kind of led me down this study of that word humility in the Greco-Roman context, tapianos, which, you know, kind of overwhelmingly has a negative connotation in that context. Yeah. Like the Greco-Roman context, like, man, no, I don't, miss me with that. I don't want anything to do with this type of, right? And yet in Philippians 2, 8, and 9, here's Paul writing to the church in Philippi and saying, it's the humility of Christ that in the incarnation, Christ took on this divine humility. And then verse 9, therefore, in light of the obedience of Christ, the humility of Christ, in light of the fact that this humility and obedience led him to the cross to defeat death through death, in light of all of this, therefore, he was exalted. And so it's like, okay, we are a culture that desires exaltation, and yet we have been conned into believing that the path to exaltation is through the unholy trinity of me, myself, and I, right? It's like, I got to do it on my own. And we think that that's going to give us peace. That doesn't give us peace. Peace is this deceitful illusion to make us believe that we're the pinnacle of creation. And peace is pride is consistently promising us clarity, but it's just leading us into deeper levels of confusion. And then what I found was fascinating about this element of peace and humility is like, well, what is the definition of humility? There's this famous quote, I think it's historically attributed to C.S. Lewis, that it's debated, but I think that's kind of like the historic kind of view is this quote, humility isn't thinking less of ourselves, it's thinking of ourselves less often. Dangerous to disagree with C.S. Lewis, so I won't disagree with Lewis, but I will suggest that biblical humility doesn't start with the self. Biblical humility actually starts first and foremost with an awareness of God. So, and I argue in the book that humility is a three-part movement. Esau, humility is first an awareness of God, because if I know who God is, then I can know who I am, made in the likeness and image of God. And if I know who God is, now I know who I am, I'm actually powerfully equipped to know how to rightly relate to other image bearers of God. And the peace is actually intimately connected to this awareness and humility, because first, I have peace with God. And that peace with God is poured out onto me. So I've got peace internally. And now I'm powerfully equipped to pursue the possibility of peace with other image bearers of Christ.
You guys, in January of 2024, I made a commitment to myself. I wanted to get stronger, which meant I needed to get in the gym, which means I needed to move my body in different ways. You guys know I love to walk. Well, it's spring, and spring is the best time for us to start a new workout routine. It's our yearly collective warm-up, and Peloton is here for everyone's yearly warm-up. This is the best time to get into a good rhythm, to tap into your power, and build towards your summer you. I love my Peloton. It accommodates to my schedule with a variety of class lengths to choose from. I can choose a 30-minute class. I can choose a 45-minute class. If you only have 5 minutes, there's literally a class to get you moving your body in 5 minutes. Peloton has a range of class types fit for every goal and every mood. There are classes if you want to hear country music, if you want to hear rock, if you want to go back to the 80s. If you can't run, take a walking class. Need some grounding? Try yoga. If you want to level up, go for their Pilates or HIIT workouts. Here's what I love is that you can move at your own pace. And that is what I'm learning that my body needs right now. It needs to move at its own pace. Peloton makes the process easier with personalized recommendations and guided programs that take all the guesswork out of working out. You guys, we think about so many things during the day. Let's take the guesswork out. Let's jump right in and let's keep our fitness journey fresh every single day. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run outdoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. I personally love a good 45-minute hip-hop class. It gets me moving. It gets me excited. It's my favorite genre of music. Just ask my kids. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com. That's onepeloton.com.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
I know the book is already done, so I'm not telling you what to add to it. but another, as you hit these streets talking about the book, there's this quote that I kept thinking about as I was reading over it. Have you heard? It's from John Paul II. Maybe it was Ratzinger. It was one of the popes. It was Ratzinger, which is Benedict XVI before he became pope. I think that's who it was. But you can Google it later on. Yeah. The internet has everything. But he talks about Christianity being a Copernic, the Christian conversion being like the Copernican revolution. Which we understand that the world doesn't revolve around us, but we revolve around God. It's kind of like this idea that, you know, the earth. And so this idea that humanity at the center of creation and everything revolving around us is ultimately a destructive idea. Now, I know you're going to not want to reduce this to something like social media.
Yeah.
But if we inhabit, you talked about this in the book, that you're someone who does social media. You even have stuff that knows about viral clips and those things like that.
Right.
How do we function as Christians? And I know you get to practice this towards the end of the book, so forgive me if I'm skipping ahead here.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we think about humility in a culture that is structured against humility, almost like in the Greco-Roman world. Like everything in our society resists humility. So how can we begin to even think about humility when we're trained to do the opposite? Do I need to get off social media or do I do something else?
Yeah, no, I think that we have to be careful that we don't take any of this to extremes. And so like what humility is, so like I view like in the Garden of Eden, one of the things that's fascinating to me in Genesis 1 and 2 is this concept of curiosity, right? And so like I actually think that God creates Adam and Eve to function in the beauty of curiosity and imagination in Eden. They're to name the animals, they're to eat of the fruit, they're to explore, they're to take the image of God and spread it out to the ends of the earth. Like Eden was on earth, but earth itself was not Eden. You know, like these are important details of the text. And yet what the enemy suggests, and I've got this whole section in there about pride. It's a two-part deal with the origin story of the enemy. And you've got the serpent, the Nakash, that steps in and suggests a curious question to Adam and Eve together. And this question is actually a curious question without limits. It actually tries to place Adam and Eve into the position of God themselves. And so what is humility? Humility is actually a guardrail. Humility is a guardrail that actually helps us to experience the joy of curiosity and imagination, but presents limits in front of us to create the creator-creation distinction. And so think about like social media. I was just speaking at an event the other day, and there's an athlete. He's actually training, I think, to be in the Olympics right now. And it looks like he might make it. And the guy came up to me. He's just like, hey, how do I like do this? Like, because I don't want to be prideful, but I'm about to like potentially be in the Olympics. You know, it's like what do I do? And same thing with social media. Like if you're a social media influencer and you've got a whole big old following, like how do you do? Do you just take a monastic kind of view and you just shut everything down and run away to the hills? I'm like, no, that's not the view of humility. What humility does is it actually helps us to receive the goodness and the beauty of our strengths without becoming obsessed with them and finding identity and value in them. Like you and I are perfect reflectors of God's glory. We're horrific absorbers of glory. And the second we try to absorb glory, it is self-destructive for us. And so it's like here we're trying to image God's image and goodness back out into the world. And part of the ways that God does this is through gifting us in these types of places, whether it be social media or creativity, your writing, as a mom and as a dad, like all these things are good things, but they can't become ultimate things.
And I want people to buy the book. And I know there's an entire appendix that says, this is how you begin to put this stuff into practice. So don't give away all of it, right?
Okay.
So, but don't give away too much. You should buy it. He's got to eat. You got four kids, right?
We got four kids, three boys and a girl.
Four kids, three. Let them eat, right? And so I got to feed the kids. So I can't give them too much. But if you want to say a quick diagnosis of how do I know if I'm enjoying the gift or getting identity from the gift, is there like a way for me to do some self-analysis there?
Yeah, I actually have a chapter in there where I bring in. You know,
that's why I said don't give them everything. Don't give them everything.
There's a chapter. Yeah, there's a chapter in there that I bring in Dr. Allison Cook, who is a clinical psychologist, faith-based, and Jim Kress, who's a licensed counselor, like clinical therapist. And in it, there are a series of questions that I provide to help you do an inventory of where you are. And here's kind of the big idea. The conversation that's happening in the hidden place in your heart is the clearest conversation that lets you know where you fall in the spectrum of idolatry and pride. And so when something good happens to you, what is the conversation inside of your heart? Is it, of course it happened, like, of course that's good because I crush it. I'm always crushing it, right?
Yeah.
If something good happens to somebody else, what's the conversation in your heart? Like, really? That person is lame. They didn't deserve any of that. Well, hey, that's an indication of something that's happening inside of your heart. And so being able to take the conversation that's on the inside of your heart and exposing it by the power of the Holy Spirit and through the context of covenant community are incredibly important steps in being able to identify where you are.
See, now you're preaching to me. This is one of the things that I've been trying to work on spiritually, is because I've tried to learn to celebrate people getting stuff that I want. And that's that's not easy. You know, you're like, oh man, you see someone who's more successful than you. And it doesn't matter who you are. There's someone who has something that you don't have. You could have financial success, but then they have social stuff. I mean, there's always something somewhere. And because the internet is alive, the internet is the endless parade of other people's success that's right in front of you. Look at this great thing that's happened to you. Yep. And so I remember seeing something like, oh, they don't deserve it. And I was like, you know what? Because the other thing that happens is people's successes remind you of your own failure. This is, I'm getting to to the humility. And because our identity is tied to what we achieve, right? So like, here we go. Like, I'm not comfortable in God. I am based upon what I achieve. Then if there's someone who's achieving that a little bit more than me, then I feel this sense of depression, not depression, like sadness. Now I'm going to ask you this question. Because you're writing a book, or you wrote a book that deals with, you talked about having a right understanding of God also allows us to have a right understanding to us that deals with the results in us having some peace. Yeah. But I also know if the internet is telling me the truth, that you do a podcast called, is it Theology and Therapy?
Yeah, Therapy and Theology. Yeah.
Okay, Therapy and Theology. See, I had it right. I Googled. Yeah. Jamie would have gotten that perfectly, but I got it mostly right. So I guess I want to ask the question of, you spoke about the anxiety and the kind of emotional distress that we have going on in our society that's skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. You're also talking about how humility is one solution. How does something like pursuing humility, which deals with anxiety, how might that match up with someone who's in therapy? I'm assuming you're not saying a lot of our social anxiety, if we just became humble, then we'll be better, so we don't need therapy anymore. How would, like, what you're proposing in the book, which also draws upon kind of insights from therapy, how might that, like, intersect with people who are in therapy? It wouldn't replace it. How do you see those two things working together?
No, it's actually going to, it's going to work together, you know, like the whole idea of therapy, and you know, this, it comes from that Greek word therapeuo, like this idea of recovering wholeness, you know, like this is the goal. What is it to be, to recover wholeness? It's to have emotional health. It's to have spiritual health, and it's to have physical health to the best of our ability in a fallen world. And so this thing about humility, like there's something that I'm doing now, Esau, which is kind of wild. Have you heard about this thing called a cold plunge? Like all the kids are doing it. It's like the cool kid thing.
I've seen it. And I'm just going to say that it's certain people who do it, who's doing the cold plunge, and there's certain people who are not doing the cold plunge. And I'm on that side.
So I started doing, I have a ministry friend, and he got me on this thing. See, I try to hoop every Tuesday night, and there's this challenge I have. Yeah. It's called Sin is Destroying My Body the Older That I Get. And so I'll hoop on Tuesday night, and then I'm basically unable to walk for 3 days, right? I got horrible flat feet. I tore my ACL 15 years ago. I'm worried my Achilles is about to tear.
I tore my ACL too.
Yep, same. So
I would tell you, I used to play basketball. I'll let you continue. I remember the last time I played basketball, I was coming up to court and I was crossing to do it over. So I was going to go left and then right. And my knee, I know it's not like it's literal, but like, you know how like the donkeys turn the ball and like, what are you doing? My knee, if it could have spoken like the donkey would have said, Esau, have you lost your mind?
You're
going to go left and right. You're going to go straight.
Right, you're about to body some people.
You're going to have to decide whether or not you want to take this charge. Because this crossing people up is over. But anyway. Yeah.
Okay, so you totally understand. So like, so basically what's happening here is I'm like, okay, how am I going to recover? My buddy was like, hey, you should try cold plunging. I'm like, this sounds miserable. I don't like the cold. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm Indian. Like, we don't go to the cold. Like, our environment is hot. And so, but I did it. And this is wild. The second you get into that cold, your body freaks out and you are so aware of your limits. You're so aware of your weakness and your vulnerability. And then there's this thing about resilience, of being able to breathe, like vital. What's vital in this whole thing is to breathe through it, right? And so you breathe through it. And once you start breathing, you settle into that moment. you know? And so once you settle into that moment, you've got a timer, it goes off, and then you get done. And, you know, there's all these studies on it. You guys can Google it. Y'all are smart. Like, it you know, it increases joy chemicals in your body. It helps with the inflammation in your body. Like, I'm telling you, I'm an eyewitness to it. It's like the eyewitnesses of Christ's resurrection. I'm an eyewitness of the cold plunging, okay? And it's like, I can walk on Tuesday nights after I get done. I can walk. And there's a health to it. So why all of this talking about humility and therapy and theology? Well, when you become aware of your weaknesses and you like are like, wait a minute, there's common grace, and the common grace is therapy. And there are actually people out there that have studied for a long time on how the human brain works and how emotions work and how anxiety is impacting our bodies. Why wouldn't we want to be like, I'm going to do that and all these spiritual practices? You know, I'm going to bring all of these things together. Pride suggests, I don't need to do it. I got it all on my own, right? Or I'm only going to do this thing because I can't trust the other thing. Humility places you in this perfect place where, and this is part of what I argue for in the book, like, what's the biggest payoff for humility? Why does the enemy hate humility? I think it's because humility gives us the gift of self-awareness. And when you have true self-awareness, John Stott has this incredible quote where he says, if pride and insanity go together, then humility and honesty go together. And it's like, oh, if you gain self-awareness, you recognize your need for help. And that is a powerful place to be in.
So I'm going to take that entire spiritual lesson, but I'm not getting in the ice. I'm just letting you know. I got the spiritual blessing, but I'm not getting in the bucket of ice. I'm got to be sore. I got it. Like, homiletically, it was effective, right? You got an analogy, created the image. I was with you. I want to go to, I want to get my therapy together. I want to get my humility together. It's that ice. Anyway, I'm going to let that go. I want to have, and I'm sure you addressed this, and forgive me if I skip this part. So one of the things about humility is sometimes there can be the fear that it's the call to be humility, the call to be humble can be used as a tool to keep, you know, oppressed people oppressed, you know, or you can say, well, I'm not going to stand up for myself because I am being humble. And it can kind of make people even being okay with mistreatment. And even something as simple as even for church leaders, they can put up with spiritual abuse because they feel like, well, this is humbling. And so how do we deal with humility as a good that God has for us, but also undeserved suffering that can be masked under the guise of humility? How do you balance? How do we work with that?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say that any type of humility masquerading around as oppression and subjugation is evil. Like, I don't know how much more clean to say that, right? Like, that's just straight evil. That's demonic, right? Like, no. So here's what I found with humility. Humility is a protection, a prevention, and a preservation. Humility actually protects us from thinking too low of ourselves. Because if we think too low of ourselves, then everybody's going to walk all over us, and nobody want to get walked all over. Humility recalls who we are in Christ Jesus. It recalls that we're made in the likeness and image of God. And if that is true, then there is innate dignity and value and worth in who we are as image bearers. It has nothing to do with what we've done and everything to do with the status that God has given us as we bear his image, right? So it's a protection. It's also a prevention. Humility prevents us from thinking too high of ourselves. Because if we think too high of ourselves, it will inevitably lead to us stepping all over other people. We will view people like they're pawns on a chessboard, and we're happy to sacrifice pawns, right, to get to where we want to get. So humility actually creates and maintains that creator-creation distinction, and humility is a preservation. It keeps us preserved in the life of Christ because that is the safest place for us to be. And so, again, I have a whole chapter in the book that I talk about humble boundaries, you know? Like, boundaries are biblical. God establishes peace in Genesis 1 and 2 through an establishment of boundaries, a series of separations. And the goal is to create harmony and peace through limits and boundaries. Yeah, you're thinking about something. Go for it.
Now, would you say that could be then a source of pride and a lack of boundaries in the sense that, like, I'm so vital to God's purposes, I have to do everything or it won't get done. And so there's a part, humility and boundaries are related because it allows you to say, because God's kingdom will go on without me and apart from my direct participation, I feel free to say no more often because I'm going to go and I'm going to get off this podcast and say about no to five other things. So I just need you to counsel me through this. Counsel me through some no's. I've heard the statement that no is a sacred word. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, absolutely. No is a sacred word. Limits are actually for our peace, for our good. And what humility does, you know, like in the ancient world, you'd have like a watchtower and you'd have a gate, right? The gate is there for a reason. You lower the gates when friends come. But if you see an enemy on the way, the watchtower guy's like yelling, alarms, gates going up, archers are at the ready, right? Humility is that. Humility is that awareness to let us know what is good for our souls and what is deceptive, what is going to desecrate our souls. And I think, so what you just talked about, I think, especially for ministry leaders and Christians in general, is what I refer to in the book as hidden pride. And what is hidden pride? Hidden pride, you know, Galatians chapter 5, Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, all that stuff. Hidden pride actually presents itself as the fruit of the Spirit, but on the inside, it's actually corrupt because it's aimed inward, not outward to glorify God and to edify his people. It's aimed inward at self-glorification and self-gratification. And all that's going to lead us in is self-obliteration. That is an undefeated idea. And so if you're like, oh man, like this is false humility. Like I'm going to say yes to everything. And at the end of the day, you're a stressed out dude. Your wife is stressed with you. Your kids are stressed with you. The ministry responsibilities and vocational responsibilities that you have, you're not able to do any of that good because you've just been saying yes to all of the things. Well, that's pride. That's hidden. You're trying to do all the right things, but the inside is actually corrupt because it's aimed inward. And it might be a fear of saying no. It might, all of these things are at play, but no might be one of the most sacred things that you can do because it's going to actually help you preserve your peace.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
I remember when I knew I had to do a better job of setting boundaries. It's when I found myself being like more easily frustrated at home. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure it out because I was like, in general, I'm a pretty patient person. I don't get upset easily. And then I realized, oh, I've expended all of my emotional energy before I got home because I'm too busy. And now like all of my emotional reserve has been gone in other places, and I need to set more boundaries so that when I come home, there's enough of me left that my children, my wife don't get the dregs. And so I do think that there's a sense in which there is this idea that there is an amount of good that you can do that you can feel comfortable with. The problem is the world has an infinite amount of pain, and the only person who can infinitely handle it is Jesus. Absolutely. And so we'll just drown ourselves in trying to fix the world's pain. Now, you talk about also in the book the relationship between, it seems to be like separate, but like how does humility and theodicy, how are those things related?
Yeah. So it's like, you know, why do bad things happen to good and humble people? You know, so like you've got this whole the whole story of Job,
great guy,
and just kind of stinks. Like, why does he have to be the one who suffers through it? And I actually think that the narrative structure of the story of Job is intended for us to see that how the story begins is actually set up for the way that the story ends. And if we remember that Job, I think this is my view. I think Job was a little bit of a helicopter parent. I think he was stressed out always about his kids, and he's always doing these sacrifices to make sure they're okay. Like that's part of his deal, right? And then we get into the discourse between Job and Yahweh, and God's kind of like, listen, where were you? And there's actually, I think it was, gosh, it's one of the Ortlands. I can't remember which one, but he wrote a great book on you know, it's like all of them are great.
All the Ortlands.
Yeah, one of the Ortlands. They're like they're the equivalent of the like an NFL family team. It's like the Ortlands are the theological.
I don't even know.
Team.
Forgive me. Are they actually? Forgive me. Are they related? I just thought they just.
They are.
I thought it was like a. Oh,
no,
is it?
Ray, Ray's the dad. Ray's the dad.
Is
Gavin.
Ortland a Dutch? Is it a Dutch name?
I don't know. We'd have to ask them.
I thought it was like Smith for like.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. No. No. Or Patel.
I didn't even
like
know.
Patel.
Yeah.
For
like
Indians.
Yeah. Like I didn't know. I didn't know. I was like, oh, like you know, like you don't want to assume that everybody has the same. Like y'all.
No.
All
no yeah.
Anyway.
They're all sons. Raise the dad, sorry. And then it's the sons. Gavin and
sorry,
Dane.
Sorry, Ortland.
Dane. Yeah. We love you, but it was one of the Old Testament scholar. I think it's Eric. I think Eric Ortland wrote this incredible book.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know the Ortlands. I'm sure they do wonderful stuff. But go ahead.
They're awesome. They're awesome. Yeah. And it's basically a deep dive in the theology of Job. It's in the biblical theology series. Anyways, he basically points out that the way that God talks to Job is a rhetorical device between a father and son. And so when he's speaking to him, he's actually inviting Job into the conversation. So here's what's happening. Job is going through all these horrible things. And he's like, why? Why is it happening? He's determined to ask the why questions.
Yeah.
And at every turn that Job asks why, God is determined to answer with who, right? Mm. And I think this is like a very simple but far from simplistic answer. You've heard the phrase, the more money, more problems, right?
Yeah.
Man, the more answers to our questions, the more questions we're going to have, right? We will never actually truly be satisfied. And sometimes the answers we do get are going to create even deeper levels of anxiety and despair. And so God is consistently like, this is that humility thing of awareness of God. God's like, every time we're asking why, he's determined to answer with the who. The who is with us. The who, you know, Psalm 46, the Lord of hosts is with us. And so that is like a deeply important aspect of the question of theodicy and the horrors that are happening in our world. And in the book, I tell a story of my cousin. She's a very close family friend. And so we just refer to her as a cousin. She was on her campus at UIC and she was murdered, assaulted and murdered. You know, why would that happen to Ruthie? And then, you know, I had my doctoral advisor, Dr. Michael Heiser, who is my second reader, as I was finishing my dissertation. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and died, you know, a couple of years ago. He had passed me through my dissertation process. It's like, why would a dear friend of mine, Pete Heinegger, at the exact same time, and we're all friends, me, Pete, and Mike, Pete got diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. Like, why? Left behind 4 daughters. Like, why? What is happening? Yeah. And at every turn, it's like there are answers that we can know and there are answers that we can't. But the thing that is going to be eternally sufficient for us is the God who is holding all of creation together and who's walking with us through all of these things. And so that's the power of humility, I think, in those moments.
I think that there is this sense in which we don't say it, but we kind of think, okay, this kind of person deserves something bad to happen to them. Right. This kind of person doesn't deserve. And there's,
right.
we don't want anyone to suffer from cancer. You know, we don't want,
right.
like, but we tend to think, oh, if this is a kind person. There's almost an inherent kind of prosperity gospel. God's going to make sure their path through life is easy. And it is hard because the people who we love and who are dear to us, who reflect God's own character, and how they treat and engage the world, we kind of say, oh, we want their stories to end. And there's a sense in which the answers to that question, you know, I remember when I used to talk to I teach undergrad here at Wheaton College. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this, when we get the issues of theodicy, there isn't an answer to the question that's going to satisfy you.
Right.
So that's going to deal with the emotional trauma. There's answers that allow us to continue in faith, right? But there is no answer that separates us from the suffering people. So what we really want is, God, give me an answer that's going to make me not feel bad.
Yeah.
But the truth is, like you said, the only answer that we get is who he is. Now, as I think about what this book could be useful for, it seems like I could imagine it almost being useful everywhere. I mean, would it be good for like a small group or a church to kind of work through it and deal with some of, I know there's resources at the end that you might want to talk about. I can even think about couples reading it together and thinking about how the better ways of understanding ourselves in a relationship with God might help in our interpersonal relationships. If you had to dream about, here's how this book can be used, how would you give us the how-to kit?
Yeah, I mean, I think you, so at the very end of the book, there's eight devotional kind of ideas called being getting grounded in humility. And it's a very practical, like you could do this if you're a husband and wife or for your family devotions, like if you're, for your family, like you could read the book individually and then at dinner or at night before you go to bed, like you could just
over the appendix.
Over the appendix. Exactly. And I think that is a very practical, because the thing about humility is it's got to be a holistic pursuit. This is not individualistic. The scriptures themselves aren't individualistic. That's a tragedy of the post-enlightenment movement, right? Like the story of scripture is a plural. There's a plurality. It's a we. Like the family of God. And so I think exercising it in the context of family would be great. And then also, I mentioned it earlier, Esau, this world's about to get wild. The political climate that we're already in, that we're walking into, I think churches are going to really, they're going to be trying to figure out, how do we shepherd our people to King Jesus in the midst of all of this? And so if you're a pastor or a ministry leader, I really do pray that this would be a type of book that you could put into your church's hands, because it's not going to talk about politics per se, but it is going to talk about the heart posture to be able to engage in a divisive world in a way that pursues unity.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not, he didn't say it, but I would say to y'all, there's a lot of sermons in here. As long as you can't, don't steal it. Like, say, as it says in my brother's book, and you know, so don't steal it, right? Don't be on the internet for going viral. But the there are topics there that I think speak directly to the human condition. And I do think that what we struggle with as a church is, what we want is peace. We want, like, most pastors are peacemakers and they want to keep everybody together. And you think the way to keep everyone together is not to discuss difficult things. And then when difficult things come, like, kind of the worst attributes of our human nature, our fallen, is manifest themselves in our political climate. And I do think there has to be heart postures that allow us to actively engage in difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. And humility and understanding, like, God's sovereignty and his control over human history allows us to dialogue with our brothers and sisters about how to discern the way forward. And so I do think there's a sense in which if we took on board these tools as kind of like the precursor to something else, because I think that what you see is, in the absence of Christian virtues like humility, we clothe ourselves in the virtues and the personalities of our political cultures. In other words, we're not trained to be humble. We're trained to be assertive, and we're trained to assume that everybody who isn't on our side is not just wrong, they're evil. And they're not just evil, they're subhuman. And because they're subhuman, I don't got to treat them as image bearers. That's but humility, like you said, allows me to see the person, myself in relationship with God, and myself in relationship to other people. And I do think that you're right, that there's a sense in which we need books like this to help us engage the world. And to recover, you talk about humility in part as the imitation of Christ.
Yeah.
And that you're equipping us in this book to be able to imitate Christ. And so I do want to encourage you. I know he won't say it. There are practices of the book. And I think he said towards the end, like, the worst thing that you could do with a book on humility is read it and then set it aside. And then you follow it up with some practical tools. So I would encourage people who are interested. But even if you're not interested in humility, if you thought to yourself, I got this, the book is probably for you. And I want to encourage you to sit down with people who you may even be wanting to have difficult, complicated conversations with, and use this book as a starting point. And then say, hey, are we engaging in this conversation in a way that might glorify God? I would also recommend it for small groups. And I think that's about it. Is anybody else who can use it? I think it's everybody. Little kids, can little kids use it? Probably not.
I mean, they might like some of the stories about my kids because it'll make your parents are going to love the stories about my kids. Like, if you're feeling down about your life, listen, my kids have been humbling me for 13 years now. And my oldest is turning 13, going on 15. You know, the one thing I'll say, Isa, and I was debating whether or not I should say this or not. You know, I pay attention to, you know, Amazon reviews and stuff like that. And to date right now, like, I think the book is doing well. There was one review that was like a 3, like I got dinged pretty hard. And I read the review, and I want to be careful in how I say this, but I think it is important that I do say, because I want to be honest about this, especially about talking about why I wrote this and the goal of it. Like, it started with like, hey, great book, loved all the stuff that he said about humility and the humility of Christ. That's great. And then it got into a section about where I talk honestly, like, I'm Indian, my wife is white, my kids are biracial. They're half Indian, half white. We go to a church that is very multiracial, right? Pastor Derwin, like, we talk about issues of justice and God's heart for his multi-ethnic family consistently. Yeah. And I share a story, a very vulnerable story in our small group once, where we're talking about one of my friends who is a black dude, has got his kids. He's talking about, it was time for him to have the talk with his boys. And the rest of us, like, you know, we kind of knew what he was talking about instantly, about the car talk, you know, when you're driving and what happens if you get pulled over. And I kind of shared that. And it was this beautiful moment where one of the guys who's white, he was listening to it, and we were talking about sex. We're like, no, we weren't talking like that's like the talk is actually a bit different for, you know, and we like, and so like, this is all framed in Paul's language of one another, the reciprocal pronoun that I'm going to be vulnerable, invite you into my life with expectation that you're going to invite me into your life, right? It's this reciprocity that's taking place. And that's kind of the biblical teaching around this illustration. And Esau, it was this beautiful moment because at the very end of it, the guy starts going in tears. You know, he's crying. He's like, man, I'm going to have the talk with my kid. And I was like, we're all like, why? Like, you guys, you know, and he said something that was so profound to us. He goes, because all of our kids are friends. And what happens if we're driving and my son is in the car with your sons and he doesn't know how to act? Like, he needs to understand. And I'm like, this is the family of God. This is the multi-ethnic family of God. And so this is an example of where, like, pride is going to, like, mess with you and you're not going to want to deal with that. You're going to want to push it to the side.
Yeah.
Humility is going to say, hey, in self-awareness, there is a story that a different people have had that we ought to actually be invited into. Isn't this what's happening for Israel? It's like the invitation of Israel's story into our story. And so anyways, I just wanted to highlight that as a very practical thing that can come out of this is peace in the context of your neighborhoods, because humility invites you into that one another relationship.
And so our reviewer didn't like that part of the book?
He did not like it. He did not like it.
One of the things that I think that is important, and maybe this is what I was trying to get at when I spoke about humility as the precursor to these conversations. We have been discipled into a way of thinking where we almost refuse to listen and learn because we think that any acknowledgement of injustice or race or anything is tied to an entire narrative that's here to kill, steal, and destroy anything related to the gospel. Mm-hmm. And it has closed our hearts to empathy, to the posture of humility. There's a strong assertiveness that I know. And I do think that part, like you said, of humility, it doesn't mean agreement. Mm-hmm. It means the possibility of learning. Mm-hmm. And I think that what happens sometimes is someone hears a story like that, and they detach it from the narrative of the gospel within which it is placed, and like the multi-ethnic people of God, and bearing one another's burdens, fulfilling the law of Christ. They take it out of that narrative in which it is set within the context of your book, and they put it in a different narrative that there are different narratives when you talk about diversity that ultimately aren't God glorifying, right? There are ways of doing that that aren't healthy. And so I think that humility involves the possibility of saying, is it possible that my Christian neighbor has something to teach me? And is it possible that the narrative that I hear around certain issues and conversations from the political parties that I am proximate to may not be the only way of discussing and understanding right. these things.
Right.
And so I think like that's the reason why I said that in some cases that there's a precursor too. Because if we don't have the precursor, we don't have the posture of this person who's speaking to me is a fellow brother and sister in Christ, and I have responsibilities to them, at least right. the responsibility of respectful listening, mm-hmm. even if it's disagreement at the end, then I don't think you can have that conversation. That's the reason why I said I think that like your book might be the precursor. So if y'all going into November, maybe you spend like the summer getting ready and then going through humility and then you can do the other stuff later. So I thank you for sharing that. And I do pray that this book gets into the hands of the people who need it. And I want to thank Jamie for entrusting me with her audience. Hopefully I didn't ruin it. If you don't like me, don't worry. I'm gone. You won't hear my voice as a host again. And if y'all can invite Joel back, but you don't got to invite me back. Thank you so much for coming. Give Derwin my
appreciate
best.
And
just say that like LeBron James is the best basketball player of his generation. Can you at least
That's an easy one. LeBron James is the greatest of all time in his era. Now I'm going to give you the one thing. Okay. And I told Derwin this, all right? If LeBron keeps playing at the level that he's playing at right now, and he plays in the same team as Bronny, all right, man. Let it be said. Let it be said.
Okay, man. I want to be honest.
I want to be honest.
Okay, man. I'm just saying you're the number one scorer of all time, top five in assists, top 20 rebounds for sure.
You need to do more. You can do that when you play 50 years.
Because his knees work better than our knees. Our knees are shot. He can still play.
Yeah, he'd be cold plunging.
If he has nothing else, he has goat knees. That's right.
He got a goat ACL and Achilles.
Yeah, goat Achilles. All right. Thank you so much for coming. And I look forward to talking to you. Maybe I'll see you in person sometime.
I'd love that.
North Carolina. I promised Derwin that I was going to stop by the church. If I'm there, if I'm in the Carolina,
hit me up. Please.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Later.
The Happy Hour is produced and hosted by myself, Jamie Ivey, with assistance from Nikki Ogden and Ashley Caldwell. And the show is edited by Jason Talley.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.